Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Critic Books podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, and this week I'm speaking to Hannah Kent. Hannah is an Australian novelist, known for her novels Burial Rites and The Good People. Her third novel, Devotion, was published this month in the UK.
Hi Hannah, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
No at all. It's very exciting. It's the first Critic Books podcast recorded across many oceans and seas. I was about to say one, but it's many. So I'm in London and Hannah, you are in Australia, aren't you?
I am, yeah. I live on Perivale Country in South Australia, just outside of Adelaide.
Which is also where a part of your new novel, Devotion, is set. So that's what we're here to discuss. And it comes out on the 3rd of February in the UK. And story of many things, but in part about the emigration of people from Prussia to South Australia, near Adelaide, I think I'm right in saying, in the 19th century as a result of religious persecution. But it's also a story of girlhood, growing up, and love in so many ways. So it's such a brilliant honour to speak to you about it. And I just wanted to ask you as a beginning question about the kind of historical inspiration for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I probably started thinking about setting a story loosely based on the emigration of Prussians to South Australia around the time that my second novel came out, for a couple of reasons, really. I mean, one, I live in South Australia, which has a very strong sort of lingering German cultural heritage, which comes from these German-speaking Prussians. You know, I live very close to the Barossa, which is well known all over the world for its wine. So that we have sort of the German viticulture. We have a lot of sort of food culture, which has come from the Germans. And growing up, you know, I would say words like Mettwurst and Bienenstick and all these sorts of things. And it wasn't really until I moved to Melbourne on the East Coast and started using these kinds of words in my vocabulary that I realized that it was quite parochial, this German immigration, that lots of other people in Australia weren't aware of how many German speakers came out, how many Prussians came out to Australia. And I'm related to a lot of these people as well. So For a little while, I was thinking, oh, there seems to be quite, a vibrant and rich history to mine there in terms of, you know, we're very familiar in Australia with colonial narratives about the British, less so with these Prussians. So I thought, okay, well, maybe that's interesting. Maybe people would like to hear more about that. But it wasn't really until I started looking at the lives of women amongst these persecuted congregations and the nature of their persecution as well, that I thought, okay, yeah, there's absolutely some meat on the bone here. There's something to gnaw on and to pursue further.
Yeah, and there really is. It's I think being in the UK, we're very aware of the fact that a lot of people were sent from Britain to Australia as part of like convict colonies in a way, and completely unaware of other emigration to Australia. I also wanted to talk about the fact that you start the novel with a recognition of the fact that the land that these Prussian immigrants moved to wasn't unused and other people did live there originally. What is it like writing about that tension between people who've always lived in Australia and then people who moved in the 19th century there, and the recognition that you're writing on? I think you call it, you have a beautiful phrase for it, but unceded land.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is unceded. And I think the tensions that have come from colonization are still there. And I think it's one of the reasons why. I mean, we have a very dark colonial past with repercussions that are ongoing and contemporary. This isn't something terrible which just happened in the past and has stayed there. I mean, it's been devastating for so many First Nations peoples. In a myriad of ways, you know, so much has been stolen and taken, and it was in one of the reasons I think why I was reluctant to write a historical novel set in Australia, because I would never write from the perspective of an Indigenous character, because that would in my eyes anyway, that would be me appropriating a view and taking up space that wasn't mine to take up. That was mine. It would be exploiting a culture that has already been exploited. So necessarily then I would have to take up the voice and the character position, the point of view of a white oppressor, of a colonialist. And that was something that I didn't want to do for many reasons, not least because I didn't, you know, when you write historical fiction, so much of it is adopting the ideological views and the worldview of your characters. You know, it didn't really seem particularly attractive for me to adopt a whole bunch of racist ideologies, or even like a colonial mindset. So that was one of the reasons why I guess I haven't done it for a very long time, because I think in the background, I've just been wondering, is it possible to write a historical novel set in Australia, which can apply, I guess, a much more contemporary understanding of the impact of colonization to that narrative, and especially to the character point of view. So that was something that, yeah, I think is probably, it took me until this book that I thought, oh yeah, maybe there are creative ways to do that. Maybe there are ways in which you can absolutely write essentially a historical novel with a modern understanding of the impact of colonization. But yeah, it's a really tricky one. I mean, there's many, many wonderful Australian writers who have written about colonial Australia, and who have tackled the issues of it in wonderful ways and have been highly articulate. And of course, there are many Indigenous and Aboriginal writers writing about it as well. But yeah, for me personally, it was about arriving at a way in which I could express my own views and my own opinion and not perpetrate any which are historical and damaging.
Yeah, and I think you negotiate that balance really brilliantly, and the tensions are very hard to avoid in like writing a modern novel at the moment. Yeah, and you definitely succeed. So the woman who you take a lot, well, she's a girl at the beginning of the novel who you take a lot of focus from, is Han. So she is 16 and living in Prussia, and is part of a family who are Lutheran at a time where it's thought to be heresy to follow that church, and they have been persecuted, and they live in a village in the forest where they still worship, and her older brother died tragically as a result of the fact that they were being persecuted. He was fleeing on a horse. I wanted to ask, I think this idea that these people who have to move to Australia and are moving, they are colonizers in one sense, but they are also being forced to flee. It's quite a difficult thing. You become quite sympathetic to people who did end up colonizing South Australia as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this was one of the interesting things which came up. I mean, and even though they were Prussians, they very quickly became, you know, British subjects upon arrival in Australia. So in one sense, you know, they are colonizers because these people came over and they took up land and eventually, you know, purchased land which did not belong to them, but which had already essentially been seized by the British. So yeah, there's absolute culpability on one hand, but on the other, yes, they were also people who were being persecuted over a number of years. You know, essentially Hannah, when the book opens, she's just on that cusp of adolescence, and her family have been persecuted essentially for her entire existence. She doesn't have very many memories of worshipping in church because the church has been barred to them. Her family refused to join King Frederick William's Union Church, this sort of collective Protestant church that he's been gradually enforcing upon his subjects. So, you know, they're not only being impacted from a financial perspective and an educational perspective. Hannah's brother is not being taught because his father doesn't want him to learn essentially the curriculum that the king is enforcing on all young subjects. But also emotionally, you know, her parents, when the novel opens, are, you know, very serious, anxious people, deeply religious, but, you know, really feeling their freedoms being stripped from them. And that to me was also worthwhile pursuing, this idea that a people who have had their freedom stripped from them, who have had their resources stolen from them, who simply want to exist in the way that benefits their community and themselves, can then emigrate to a place where they essentially perpetrate the same crimes upon the people living there.
Yeah, it's really tricky. You talk very early on in the novel, Fia, who is Hannah's, she and they love each other. Her family have lost everything once before because they thought they would be able to emigrate, and so they sold all their possessions, and then they no longer can. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
huge sense of instability. I also wanted to talk about the fact that, so it begins with a story of religious persecution. You said that you started writing the novel in 2017 after Australia legalized gay same-sex marriage. And so in the novel, Fia and Hannah, they start off as friends and then they realize they feel far more deeply for each other. What was it like writing about religious persecution in the sense that the Lutherans weren't allowed to worship, as well as a kind of oppression or suppression of like same-sex desire as well?
Yeah, it wasn't something that actually, that wasn't a parallel that occurred to me in a very obvious way. I think it was something that emerged probably from just organically from this sort of collection of interests. I actually didn't set out to write this novel as a love story. Initially, when I was interested in writing about, you know, the Germans in South Australia, the Prussians here, I wanted to write about women. I knew that. But I was interested in writing about friendship. I was interested in the idea that a friendship might be the most significant relationship in your life, even though you might marry and have children. And because so little is written of the bonds between these women, you know, because so much was, you know, there was so much virtue placed on being modest and humble and of staying in the background. Of course, I was naturally interested in them, and that's what I wanted to bring to the fore. And then 2017 happened, and you know, it was we had a plebiscite over here, you know, a massive public vote with, you know, which was awful in so many ways and really traumatizing. And also when the vote came out in favor of same-sex marriage and politicians agreed to sort of abide by the public vote, a cause of massive celebration. And I thought to myself then, you know, because I'd already started writing these two characters, these two young women who were going to form this friendship, I thought it's not enough. You know, I'm a member of the queer community. We need these stories, you know, we need representation, we need to be present. And I thought, you know, I think these two girls need to fall in love with each other. I think this needs to be a love story. And as soon as I made that decision, it was like, you know, putting fingers to the book's heartbeat. You could feel the pulse immediately. It was like, yes, this is alive. This is where the story is. This is where it needs to be. And so I didn't necessarily make that connection between persecution and obviously, you know, the persecution of those who are homosexual, but I because I'd already started doing that research, but naturally all these themes started to tie in as I sort of started writing and continued. But yeah, it was such a nice moment thinking, no, I want to write a book that I want to read, you know, as a queer woman. I want to read a love story, and I want to read one that isn't couched in shame. I want to read something which is higher than that.
Yeah, and it's completely beautiful. I really don't want to spoil any of the plot details for any of our readers who might read it when it comes out next week, but it's also a very heartbreaking love story. You're not very kind to your readers.
It's hard, right? It's so hard because, I mean, within a historical context, I mean, I basically had already picked this very pious background. And then I decided to, you know, put in this beautiful love story in the midst of it. And I was just like, there were many times during the writing process where I was like, what have I done? Why couldn't I just pick like a more tolerant society? How am I going to write this? But I think it works in the end. So necessarily, because it is set in a time where these two girls, Hannah and Taya, they don't even really have the language initially to speak to their feelings. They sort of are kind of aware of them, but that kind of clear-eyed vision and understanding of just what exactly they do feel and how much they mean to each other doesn't arrive until a little bit later on. And some other things have to happen before they really can acquire the vocabulary to speak to that depth of feeling.
Yeah, and that idea that feelings can't always be written or said in words is something that reverberates throughout the book, with the sense of synesthesia and the land kind of taking on almost a speaking role as they move, where they get on boats from Europe to Australia as well, and both the land in Russia and Australia almost kind of puts words into things as well. Very weird sense.
Yeah.
Very eloquent way of explaining.
Yeah, absolutely. I was really interested in, I mean, I always knew that Hannah, who's the narrator and the protagonist of the novel, that she was different. And there are several things that make her different. And I didn't want to necessarily pick things that would leave her on the outer necessarily, that she would see in a negative sense. And so I really wanted to give her this kind of synesthesia where she just finds rapture and joy in the natural environment, because it sings to her and speaks to her and that lends her life a divinity that she gets not just from church but from, you know, her environment, that the people, the congregation, this very pious congregation, I mean, her father's an elder, don't get. So she is she is othered through that experience that she has, but it's also something that she loves about herself too.
So in many ways, quite an important plot point is the presence and the ability of, I hesitate to call it witchcraft, but a kind of spiritual power and kind of maybe the occult or something, in a way, which kind of reverberates throughout the book right from the very beginning, when it becomes clear that Thea's mother has healing powers. And you have a brilliant description that she is a midwife and she always knows when the mothers are about to have a child before they know, in a way. And I wondered both about the historical importance of writing about that. Obviously, witch trials are a very famous thing that happened kind of globally as well. And also the non-historical, like why that is so important to how these women kind of function in a way.
Yeah, I was, it's funny, you know, because when I started writing devotion, originally I thought I would write it in a similar way to Burial Rites and the Good People, where I would do as much research as possible, like completely saturate myself in this time and place and the people I was writing about, and really honor those facts. So anchor anything that was fictional or imaginative to, you know, a fact or to something which was likely, you know, it was fictional likelihoods. When I started writing devotion, as soon as I decided that I wanted to center a love story between two women, I freed myself from those sort of shackles to the historical record and thought, no, I can invent here. It was part of me necessarily having to do so, because I could just find no evidence of same-sex relationships. I mean, but of course I would never find any. But also, you know, creatively speaking, it would allow me to try some new things as a writer and allow me not to necessarily just paint myself into a corner doing the same thing again and again. But then, of course, I did do research and I would occasionally find these amazing bits of information and I thought, oh God, I have to put that in there. And I had no intention of creating any characters which sort of dabbled in something which might be called witchcraft. I'd done a lot of that with The Good People, with folklore, with herbal remedies, and I didn't necessarily think I'd return to that territory. But what I found in so many accounts of these Lutherans who emigrated was that many of them held suspicion towards a small group, a minority amongst them, who were Wendish, and now known more commonly today as the Sorbs. And these were people with sort of Slavic origins who were old Lutherans, like these congregations were, but were rumoured to be highly superstitious, were rumoured to sometimes engage in occult activities or hold black masses. And I just could not get away from the stories. I encountered all these incredible tales about this grimoire, this book that many congregations brought out with them, the 6th and 7th books of Moses, which you can find still to this day. And I remember I found it and I was so excited, and I was translating it from the German, which was a very slow and arduous process. But you know, and it's, on one hand, it's remedies for, you know, sleepwalking, and then you turn a page and it's how to sort of, you know, invoke demon assistance. And I remember translating that thinking, you know, I really hope these demons know I'm just doing my research. I'm not really, you know, holding an invocation here. And other, you know, just anecdotal stories of people from the Barossa or from Harndorf, which Heiligendorf, the village in the book, is very closely based on, stories of people tying red ribbons around their necks to, you know, to not be hexed, and cows, you know, being stolen for their milk, people milking rope ends. It was amazing. I actually ended up meeting a historian who lives in one of the original cottages that was built in this village that I've based the one in the book on. And she was able to go out and show me this amazing ruins. And she showed me a little hole within the foundations and said that was where they hid the grimoire. And then she's told me these stories about this black witch and this white witch who used to like feud in the 1850s. And it was just like, I keep on finding this information. I have to put it in there. Anyway, and so all of these incredible tales were sort of distilled to this one character, a Wendish character called Anna Maria, who is Thea's mother. And that was also, that opened up so much to explore too, in terms of Hannah's characterization and the way that she feels that she is a different sort of person. She's not at ease in her femininity and in her womanhood. She feels very different to her pious family, who are able to do everything by the book. And then she meets Taya, and she also meets Taya's family. And, you know, they're sort of sensual where her family is not, and they're affectionate where her family is not. And I was able to sort of manifest all these other differences, a different kind of aspect to the people belonging to these communities through this one character. But yeah, it was an amazing part of the research process, actually. It was sort of so uncanny and weird. I just kept meeting people who would be like, oh, have you been to this, the national park? You know, go to this path and you'll be able to find the original altar for the Black Mass. I mean, it's crazy, the stuff I found. I had no idea living here about it all, but it was just everywhere. So yeah, so that's why that element of the book is in.
Absolutely amazing. I had no clue that it had so much real basis. That moment where Tia shows Hannah the book, the sixth and seventh book, and then she says that she can't show her the other one because her mother won't let her either. I had no clue that that had actual basis in fact.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Brilliant. The State Library here owns a copy. And I mean, there's just so many stories of people making bonfires of them, of people who are prepared to own a copy of this book, having their coffins being dropped 3 times to sort of, you know, dispel any lingering evil. I could just go on for hours. There was just so much information. So, I mean, I feel like even though I had been like, I can do what I want with this book, I can, you know, riff off historical fact, when confronted with that kind of interesting stuff, you have to go with it, right? It was fascinating. So yeah, I was really excited that I could weave that book, particularly through the character of Anna Maria, and also through the lives of Taya and Hannah and the journey to South Australia.
Yeah, so a very large part of the novel is about the journey itself from Prussia to South Australia, and the family spend six months on a ship. I also wanted to ask about the historical fact and basis behind that, because it sounds so traumatic. I think we're all more used to spending a lot of our lives inside than we otherwise would like to be in recent years, but at least we have space and we have houses and we're not stuck below deck on a ship.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this, I mentioned the Book of Moses and how much that, or sort of all the more uncanny dramatic aspects of the book are really the ones drawn from historical fact, and the same is true of the ship journey. I based it very closely on the journals of Dirk Hahn, who was the captain of the Zebra, which was a ship that brought over about 200 of these Prussian immigrants to Adelaide. And he kept this wonderful captain's log, and most of it, I found it in the State Library, and I was reading it. It had already been translated. There was all this really, you know, quite dry information about a chronometer that he'd purchased, and, you know, there was the ship surgeon seemed a bit iffy, but, you know, largely he just talked about the journey, and he'd never been to South Australia before, so it was his sort of concern. He kind of occasionally would mention the immigrants, and so I kept reading it, hoping for those small details, you know, at least I would get the quantities of, like, the salted herrings that were brought on board, all this sort of stuff. And then towards the end of the journals, there's sort of an epilogue where he says that, hey, he had not been absolutely true in his depiction of them previously. He previously called them very pious. He mentioned that they sang a lot and prayed a lot and held sort of endless services. And then he goes on to state all the various conflicts which actually happened on board, which he hadn't written about, because he was worried he would have to be called to testify in court because some of these conflicts were ongoing. So suddenly there is this, in this captain journal, this list of all these terrible things which happened, you know, these bunks which collapsed on the first day out at sea because of inept sort of carpentry, and the fact that there weren't even enough berths to begin with. So some people had to go out and sleep on the top deck, which was already too filled with, you know, strapped down barrels. People had to climb over them. You started hearing about these passengers fighting amongst themselves, and as the rations sort of dwindle and the water is polluted that they've brought on board, people are arguing about old things that they left behind in the village. There's a doctor, which previously he'd sort of acknowledged wasn't that great, but now we find out that the doctor had actually given medicine adulterated with broken glass, like glass fragments, to children, and had also tried to experiment with live smallpox inoculations on board. So I mean, it was suddenly just this wealth of information and this wealth of conflict. And suddenly, for the first time reading these journals, I really saw just the human face of a lot of the hardship of that journey. And it was just too good to leave in my research books. I had to put it in there. Before that, I really hadn't intended to spend that much time on the journey, because I don't know what it's like to, you know, travel in a 3-masted ship. I had no idea, and there was not a great deal of information, which would tell me the kind of small details that I think you need as a novelist to render it in a sort of a cinematic or compelling way. But suddenly with this captain's log, it was just filled with just so many accounts of just these awful things that happened. And also some lovely things, some families who were deeply spiritual and deeply selfless, friendships that were struck up. Lots of tragedy, of course, as you can imagine, on boats like that. But it really did, yeah, give me a different perspective from sort of the bald statistics of, you know, we set out with so many souls and arrived with a few less. Suddenly you had an account of how those souls were lost and just how people managed. And oh my God, I'm so grateful I don't have to ever do a journey like that in my life.
Yeah, me too. It's incredibly, incredibly, you write it beautifully, but it does sound incredibly traumatic for all of them. Fleeing one place to get to another in the hope of a better life, you have to spend 6 months stuck without even a bed really to sleep in.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they were sharing beds. And then there's a maritime museum here. And I went to it just to see if I could find anything. And they had actually reconstructed the typical sort of, berths, or sort of the what would you call it? Like, you know, very much the sort of third class berths of an emigrant ship. And you can lie in them, and they've recreated the sound. So there's speakers hidden amongst these wooden berths, which are already incredibly narrow. So you can hear sort of people groaning and the ship creaking. And I remember lying in this museum, and it was such a gift. And it really did give me this kind of very immediate sense of what it would have been like to have been in an incredibly close, confined environment with a bunch of people who you might not have liked a great deal for such a long time, for 6 months. I mean, it's extraordinary, really.
Yeah, it really is. Oh, thank you so much for talking to me about the book. And I can't wait for people to read it and for it to be out over here. It's so exciting.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you. I really hope people enjoy it.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.